poverty and vulnerability. I'm sure many of you
understand the concepts, but I'd like to sort of, you know, explain or clarify to those who are not yet clear about the difference between the two. Talk about it. I'll talk also about risk, but I'm not going to focus about investor risk or financial risk. I'm going to talk about the risk faced by poor households. I'm going to talk about risk management and coping strategies. I'll talk a little bit about insurance and the different types of insurance. Then I'm going to give two case studies based on the work that I have done. One is a work in progress, and I'll be examining the urban poor and their self-insurance mechanism in the absence of social insurance and in the fact that they are rationed out or excluded or not reached by any kind of private or formal market insurance. Then I'm going to talk about another important strategy by the poor, owning assets, asset ownership, and asset pawning. Okay. By the way, the second case is a work that I've done in collaboration with Rania Antonopoulos. So, okay. Vulnerability and poverty are oftentimes used synonymously. They are related, especially in the risk poverty chain, but they are distinct concepts. Poverty, we all know, is an outcome manifested in various forms: hunger, illness, powerlessness. Okay, you have different concepts of poverty: income poverty, human poverty. Okay. Vulnerability is not the outcome; it's the process of impoverishment. It defines the probability of falling somewhere in some future, that you fall below a certain benchmark of welfare. Okay. You may not necessarily fall, but you have some probability or idea that you will, or some expectation. Okay. Now, I think vulnerability is a very important intrinsic aspect of well-being. I think the financial crisis is raising this point even more. If you go and Google how many times the word vulnerable is used in media now, in the news, it appears much more often than in the previous years. And as even the World Development Report of the World Bank recognize, risk and uncertainty is a central preoccupation of the poor. Okay. Now, relative to the studies and empirical research on poverty, vulnerability is only gaining attention among economists in recent years. It's not that they ignored it. It's just sort of more systematic examination of vulnerability. There's some very interesting work, not necessarily done by gender-aware economists, but nonetheless interesting and good development economists like Stefan Dercon or Jonathan Murdoch. Okay. Some people also, like Michael Carter, has done some work on this. What happens to income or changes in income ranking is one way you measure vulnerability. Also, the probability of becoming poor. And, of course, this is for non-poor households only. What's the likelihood? It also, other proxy for vulnerability is the coping strategies people use. We'll talk about that in a little while. And also the extent to which income shocks translate to consumption shocks. Okay, has to do with, for example, not having access to food, even though there's food sufficiency in the country. Okay, or ample supply of food. Okay, and another measure of vulnerability is changes in wealth. Okay. Now, I'm going to focus on a segment of the population that has probably one of the highest expectation of that are very much exposed to different types of risk, and that's poor households. And the poor, whether they're rural or urban, have some fewest instruments or resources to deal with risk. They're the most vulnerable when shocks come. Talk a little bit later about what type of shocks do they face. Okay, you have to understand the fact that if they feel vulnerable, or if a person feels vulnerable, your actions and decision is going to be different than if you're not. If you incorporate risk and uncertainty in a person's decision, whatever decision it may be, you realize that that decision is going to be different than if there's no risk or uncertainty. Financial economics shows, provide ample evidence on that. Household vulnerability, in turn, depends on a variety of factors. Okay. Oftentimes, studies focus on the household characteristics. Education, for example, skills level, household composition and dependency ratio. Okay, if you have lots of young dependents, you're female-headed, you're more vulnerable than if you are a two-income or three-income adult household. Your asset base, landless versus being having landed. You may be subject to the same shock, but those with land will have much better coping mechanism and ability to survive or deal with shock than those who don't have land. Access to various markets also. If you have access to credit, formal or informal, makes a difference than those who don't have any access whatsoever. Or if the cost of credit is too high. Okay. Access to various networks, social support, as well as public support. Okay. And the macroeconomic environment. Now, all of these factors affect the level of risk a household faces, ability to cope, and hence its vulnerability. And they're linked in many numerous complex ways. Now, I'm going to quickly, given the time, I'm going to talk a little bit about risk management and risk coping strategies. Okay, in the literature, you talk a lot about coping strategies, especially among poor households, in periods of financial crisis, or economic crisis, downturn, and so forth. In the literature on area of risk and vulnerability, they conceptually or analytically differentiate between the different types of strategies. One is what you call prevention strategy. You reduce the probability of downside risk. Okay? In the literature, sometimes they call it like risk averse. Mitigation strategies. Okay, you may not be able to reduce the probability of the risk or the shock occurring, but you can decrease its impact. Okay, a good example would be livelihood diversification. If you know if your earnings are variable and you're not unreliable, you're going to find another way to augment your variable income. Hedging is another coping strategy. Insurance, and I'm going to talk a little bit about insurance. There are different types of insurance. There's self-insurance or household-level insurance, internal. There's mutual insurance, say, among communities, like savings clubs, roskas, you know, ways of getting together. In Indonesia, for example, there's what you call the funeral societies. And what do you think? What's this funeral society? Well, the funerals are very expensive, so there's an insurance mechanism in some communities to ensure that when a person dies, that the household doesn't have to bear all of the costs. Okay. And you have also, of course, social insurance. Okay. Then you have what you call coping strategies. You experience the shock, but you have to find ways to relieve the impact. So you didn't avoid the shock, but you have to cope with it and deal with it. Okay. Oops. Okay. Now, let me talk a little bit about risk management strategies. In the literature, there is the term ex-ante risk management, which are actions taken before the risk is realized. A good example, among the urban poor, one of the things that was so critical and so obvious to us when we were doing our field work and also our data shows is the health shocks. Okay, we'll see why. All you have to do is look at the environment and you realize how often they get sick. Okay. Case of malaria. Here's an example of a risk, you know, management. Risk prevention, you can eliminate malaria carrying mosquitoes, you know, by spraying the area. Okay, malaria eradication kind of program, social provisioning. You can also do it at the self-insurance level in the household. You can take pills, malaria pills, use mosquito nets, etc. Or you can take some risk mitigation. You may not always be able to avoid malaria or mosquitoes. Take insurance. So in case it happens to you, you're not devastated by it. Okay. Now, the ex post risk management are actions taken after the risk is realized. It's different from coping. Coping is dealing with the actual risk involved. This one are coping responses like food aid, disposal of assets, reduction of food consumption, borrowing, withdrawal of children from school, child labor. Now that you realize you are vulnerable, that you're subject to this kind of shocks, you have some idea how often this may take. Predictable, like for example, flooding. Okay, many parts, for example, of South Asia is prone to flooding. You already sort of anticipate it, and you get to sort of do some coping strategies. Okay. Now the term insurance, you know, if you're in the just looking at the formal economy, you have private insurance, you can buy your own health insurance, for example, which is very expensive in the United States in developing. Or of course you have access to insurance through your employer, or you have social insurance through the government. Now, the market or the private insurance tend to miss out the poor. No insurance. If they look at your income and look at your situation, you says, my goodness, you're prone to so many. We cannot give you insurance, sorry. Or the insurance is so prohibitively expensive, you don't buy it. So many poor households and communities tend to form their own informal insurance mechanisms, okay? Like group savings. But there are limitations to mutual insurance. Idiosyncratic shocks or individual-related shocks, you can deal with it. But if it's a covariant or aggregate shocks, like everybody is subjected to flooding or typhoons or hurricanes, the whole community is devastated, the informal mechanism doesn't work. You also have self-insurance, and that includes migration strategies. Households would have at least one family member earn abroad, because in the face of any shocks in the country or in the community which you're faced, at least you have some other source of earnings. You have to look at it also, another way of looking at remittances from the household perspective. Okay, I'm going to skip that because I know. How much time do I have? 10 more minutes? 15? Okay, good. What I'm going to do is talk about two studies. One of them is a work in progress. It's only preliminary. And it looks at gender dimensions of vulnerability and examine employment choice of self-employed workers. So here in the informal sector, you can choose whatever occupation you want, any production activity you want, economic activity, and you find there's certain trends that are interesting from a gendered perspective. I want to examine that, the notion of self-insurance and food security. The second case I'm going to talk about is a coping strategy of households in the face of shock, and that is asset pawning. Okay, so I'll start with this first case study. Okay, the study that I'm going to talk about focuses on urban poor households, the shanty towns. Okay, they represent over 1/3 of LDC's developing countries' urban residents. In Manila, where I come from, an estimated of 13. Well, this is no longer, it's not 13.2 million. What's the current? I think it's close to 17 or 16 million. An estimated 40% live in squatters, okay? Maybe even larger. In Africa, it's even more serious. Now, Urban informal sector workers are exposed to diverse risks. Let's start with the environment in which they live. Okay? They're vulnerable to shocks, and when they face adverse shocks, they resort to coping strategies that entail irreversible long-term losses. Once you make a decision, there's somewhat a path dependency. You can get trapped in that kind of situation, and it becomes more and more difficult over time to get out of it. Okay? Such as if you sell your productive assets, I am in distress, I sell my land. Well, you're not just to deal with the situation now. Well, you have basically limited your options for future in terms of future income. Okay? Or interruption of education that permanently reduces human capital. Okay? So given the multiple risks that these house workers and their households face, they also make decisions that allow them to mitigate or manage risk. One of the things, here are some photos of some shanty towns, okay, just in case. I'm sure you've seen one of them, at least you've seen them in many of your countries, but the study that I'm going to discuss examines a very interesting phenomenon that a doctoral student of mine many years ago have commented on. She was doing her dissertation on microcredit in the Philippines. And she says to me the following, you know, Maria, I don't understand these women. They're part of the gamine replication program in one of the islands in the Philippines, in Aklan. They said, you know, they borrow and they keep on choosing only two types of livelihood, food business, food vending, or piggery. In nearly 90% of all the women respondents and members of the Grameen Bank, they tend to choose this. I don't understand it. Okay? And sure enough, in the study that we've done among urban poor, we look at among self-employed workers, so we don't include the dependent or piece rate workers, contracted workers, we observe certain trends. And I was also talking to Butch Montes a few years back, after I came back from my trip and did my own interviews and field work in Manila, I said, you know, I went to the slum communities in the Philippines, and every fourth house or every third house has a small sari-sari store. And they sell the same things. I mean, in one community of 2,000 residents, there must be at least 70 sari-sari stores. It's excessive competition. From a rational perspective, why in the world would you open a third one if three doors down you have the same another neighbor selling exactly the same thing? Rice, cigarettes, of course, by the stick, oil, cooking oil, and you don't buy the whole bottle or can, you buy it by a cup, you know, candies and so forth, bread, etc. So it sort of is a puzzle that's like, are they poor because they really don't make this decision sort of like efficiently the way we think from an economic standpoint, or is there other explanation? Well, what we did, so we asked these questions: in what manner does vulnerability affect the decisions made by urban informal sector workers? Why, in particular, women tend to subject themselves in activities, this is self-employment, it's choice, to activities that are in excessive competition and have low returns, such as food-related businesses. Many of these stores are open like how long? 10 hours, 12 hours, 6 days a week. If you calculate the hourly earnings of these stores, it's very small. Think about the food vendors in many of the capitals and cities and towns in developing countries. They stay there all day and nearly all night. Why do they do it? Thank you. So, what we argue is the following. An urban self-employed worker's choice of food business is determined not only by her household's degree of vulnerability, but there's also an important gender dimension. We observe, for example, this concentration or what you call crowding into this food-related occupation by women relative to men. Okay. Of course, food-related businesses, and we argue that their gender-ascribed roles in the household that affect the opportunity and constraints faced by the worker. Some of these food-related businesses are home-based work, so you get to see already that gender dimension in it. Now, when we started looking at the literature, there's not quite a lot to start with. There's not really very many studies done on this area, surprisingly. Hazel Malabi did an excellent job in writing a paper, research paper actually, on sari-sari store and digging into the historical and anthropological evidence about food businesses in the Philippines. And it goes way back in the colonial period. So it's not like a phenomenon that we observe now. It's been observed by anthropologists and sociologists and historians way back when. Okay. Also, Das, who did some work on self-employment in India, also observed similar things, but couldn't explain the puzzle. Mark Coulier and Castilla, 1995, did some sort of interesting study looking at differences between informal sector workers and formal sector workers using household surveys and labor force surveys in several countries. Here's what the explanation they come up with. Well, you know, these food businesses, whether it be food vending or retail store, they have low entry costs. It's very easy to get into. You don't need a lot of skills. Well, at least you need to cook if you're selling food. No? Low opportunity costs. That's what their argument. There's low opportunity costs. There's need for flexibility due to young children being present. So women can combine both the reproductive responsibilities as well as income earning opportunities, social network development. And according to McCullier and Castilla, there are net positive benefits of informal job. This is very flexible. You can close the shop whenever you want to. You don't have to sell in the street if you don't feel like it. You can sell when you need to. You don't want to sell now? Fine. Okay, so that idea of advantage of flexibility. Well, in thinking about it and looking more at the data, and I'll talk a little bit, we find that there's an argument, even interesting argument and a story along that the food business is actually a form of self-insurance. It's actually a way by which households pay food security. You cook for the household, or you have a sari-sari store, you have ingredients there that you can also use for your own consumption. You can sell it and make profit, or you can eat, consume it. So joint consumption and production. That's unsold inventories, if you don't sell it, you can eat it. Time saving due to jointness of production and consumption. So, but you're having a trade-off. It's not that there's always net benefits to it, because you're giving up monetized earnings that are low and highly variable. You know what you're getting into. It's going to be very competitive. Okay. So there are trade-offs, and therefore, the net benefits of so-called flexible informal employment in terms of food business, it's not clear. So we wanted to see and test this and explore this. What we are doing right now, we're using cross-section data of more than 1,300 in urban informal workers, men and women, collected in 2002. And it is a targeted sample because it was only collected in urban squatter communities in four countries, on Bolivia, Ecuador, Philippines, and Thailand. This questionnaire is comparable, and it was asked both for men and women. What we intend to do, and we household head and spouse, is to explore this further, to compare women in food business versus men in food business, and actually we find that net earnings in men in food business is much higher. We want to also compare women in food business versus women in non-food business. We also want to compare whether the difference between women who are self-employed in food business versus women wage workers. Okay. And indeed, our preliminary findings shows that we have women in self-employed business tend to choose food business, and these have lower earnings and lower returns to labor. We did some preliminary results, and what's interesting, I'm not going to have time to explain the variables. I can go back to it if you want to. The gender or the sex here. It's negative, which means it's highly probable that you're engaged in food business if you're a woman. Okay. So what we intend to do is use our results to interpret the following story. That the gender is really much more nuanced. There's an added dimension of women's role in food security that makes them go also into food business. Okay. So we want to link the story on engagement in food business and excessive competition to look at it from a perspective of self-insurance. Having little time, I'm going to go next to the second case study on asset pawning among vulnerable households. Okay, this time the data that we're focusing, that Rania and I have focused on, are the squatter community informal low-income households in Thailand. And we asked the following questions. Do low-income households own assets, even those who are poor? It's squatter community, they don't own the land. By the way, if you're a squatter, that means you don't own the land that you are occupying. And if so, what is the pattern of ownership? Then we also ask the second question, as part of coping strategy, do households pawn their assets, and which members of the households do? Okay. We find that there are gender differences in asset ownership within these households. You assume in asset ownership, when you look at wealth, as if everybody owns the same thing, there's jointness, but it's not always the case. We find, for example, just gonna skip that, that women and men actually own very little joint assets. Men have individual assets and women have individual assets in this community. What's also interesting is the importance not just of financial assets. We think of assets always like either housing or savings or money in the bank or deposits. No, we're also talking here of real assets like television sets and radio and jewelry, which are often perceived sometimes, well, look at the poor. The reason they're poor is they spend so much money on television set, on jewelry. You know, they could use that money to invest in their business and make more money. But realize that these consumption goods are actually savings. Assets serve as important precautionary savings to help soften the blow of an economic shock. In fact, it's a very wise strategy. I use the TV when I don't need to pawn it. I can pawn the TV and get money when I need it. Have greater returns from that asset than if you put it in the bank. Okay? So in our finding, in terms of ownership, a lot of them own household appliances, but we realize that some of these appliances are actually pawned when they need cash. Okay? Men's primary real asset is vehicles, transportation, bicycle, anything from bicycle to carts to motorcycles to even some form of truck. And women's assets includes sewing machines and jewelry, a lot of jewelry. Okay. We also find that in case of low-income households, women are more likely to pawn their own assets than men. There's a very interesting gender trend, okay? Women go to pawn shops or pawn brokers to pawn their jewelry, okay? And this is to deal with shocks, okay? So you begin to see asset depletion and asset accumulation in an uneven way, okay? So thank you.
Hi, Sergi. So thank you very much. I always enjoy listening to you, and I learn so much. And I'm especially thankful for the framework that you have laid out, because I have been doing some work on gender and climate change, specifically gender and climate change financing, and have been thinking through within the normative framework for climate change, right, under the United Nations Framework Convention, it is accepted the notion of vulnerability, equity, differentiated rights, responsibilities, and obligation as between countries. What we've been trying to do is to introduce a gender dimension of that by saying that climate change, to the extent that it generates systemic disequilibrium and discontinuity in the economic growth path, impacts on the existing vulnerabilities of women and increase the risk of women. And then taking the existing risk and saying how climate change actually heightens and worsens those risks, which means, therefore, that the current financing process, which focuses, A, to the detriment of development because it's biased towards mitigation, which is transition towards a low-carbon economy and reducing GHG, whereas adaptation has to do with how you adapt to climate-related events. So that, A, more money needs to go to adaptation, which is more linked to development and the questions underlying development. But within that context, it needs to go to women's activity in terms of climate proofing their residence and climate making their occupations climate resilient. So you need to pay attention to the care economy as well as the informal economy instead of just focusing on large scale mitigation projects, which are very high technology, high capital intensive. So I've been trying to think creatively about how you introduce this framework of risk and vulnerability, which is already inbuilt in the climate change discussion, except it's about national risk, national vulnerability, and LDC risk and LDC vulnerability. So my thing that I'm struggling with, and it was really nice to listen to your presentation, is how to gender that. And part of the discussion is about creating catastrophic bonds for like SIDS country like Jamaica and the Pacific. And so I've been trying to think through how do you construct a climate change risk assessment framework that is gender sensitive and that brings in some of the concerns that you've brought up? Because I think climate change puts another level of struggle and challenges on the risk assessment framework that you're assessing, in the sense that women then not only need to do their traditional coping skill when there's a climate change event, as we've seen the data on what has happened to women, that 90% of the people who got killed in the weather-related event were women, both in the tsunami and various other factors. And there are other issues of forced migration, sexual harassment, and that climate change brings new dimension to health. Exhaustion from heat, right? Greater food insecurity, a whole host of other. It also increases women's time burden because they have to be shifting patterns of cultivation as they move back from sea coast areas and are shifting, trying to get new plant varieties and so forth. So I'm hoping that I could adopt the framework that you've put here with the climate change dimension. So I hadn't remembered it. And so I was struggling on my own. So this is kind of really great that you put that on. I could talk with you a little bit about how we do some of that. Yes?
Yes. I enjoyed your presentation. However, I would like to make a comment for your consideration. You know, coming from a country where the risk and vulnerability is very high of different kinds, you know, it has been experienced in a lesson which is emerging out of the debate is that risk could be and should be integrated in the development process. So if you're in the development process, so if you integrate the element of risk in the development process, then that reduces and that mitigates the risk in a very effective way. I mean, other things are of course necessary, but the minimizing of the occurrence of risk and vulnerability is very much there in the development process. So your development model is very important. For example, if your model is depending on natural resource management and sustainable development, then you will have less of disasters and less of effects of disasters at least. Or you have employment intensive development process, then that also helps. Your urban development, for example, if it is not concentrating on just urban growth and things like that, and it concentrates on healthy development of urban areas, then again it reduces risk, etc. So healthy or development path which integrates risk into the in mainstream strategy can be also a very effective strategy.
I don't know if we're monopolizing the mic, but I have a quick question. I mean, I thought the pawning example was like, you know, really for me, it was very easy to think of that as insurance. But given how little you suggest that women earn from the food businesses, that was kind of more complicated for me to think through in the sense that how does it really serve as a form of insurance? And I was wondering, I don't know if y'all have discussed this, but I mean, does it... So you were saying, for example, that they can consume the inventory that's not sold. But it strikes me that, you know, you would be buying less rice every month if you didn't have the rice store. So, I mean, I know Hawaii might be better than another business, but I'm not sure why you have the business at all if you don't have earnings. And I was wondering if it allows the women to, because they claim to be running a business that generates a little bit of income, if then they get more control over household decision making, or they manage to, you know, convince the man to actually buy the rice, you know, I'm not sure if there's something going on there, but or maybe just I just didn't understand the insurance part as well. So,
I have a question about also the little businesses women have been undertaking, maybe compared to other countries. I don't know if you have any. You know, information on that, like what, depending on the social framework, what kind of support are given to women in different contexts, do they still concentrate on one or two sectors or do they diversify?
First of all, I agree with Mariama. There's a lot of things that we can still explore on gender and climate change. I'm currently writing a paper on actually examining the way neoclassical economics has handled care of people and care of environment. So I'm trying to bring the feminist and the ecological economics perspective into the front. Yes, there's a lot of interesting terms that are parallel to the discussion of vulnerability in the environment. Adaptation resilience is another term. Are you resilient or not? Exhaustion, depletion, okay, renewable and irreversible versus reversible. As you could see, a lot of the ideas that I have here actually comes from the ecological environment. The point of Indira Hirway, yes, I think the financial crisis is now giving us, all of us, a lesson, both policymakers and economists and research academics alike, that we have to deal with risk. Risk is here with us, okay? And we need to know how to cope with it, not in a very sort of ad hoc kind of, you know, sort of reactive way, but in a very strategic fashion and a comprehensive one. And I think going to the point that was raised earlier by Rania, microcredit has to be seen as a part of a broader comprehensive strategy. It's very easy to just say, oh, for women to do beyond food business, we have to give them more credit. Well, we are going to examine, because we have data on credit here, whether indeed credit plays a role in the so-called self-selection of women between, you know, among different types of businesses. So we'll see. Smita, on the issue of self-insurance. I think there are many dimensions of this food-related business. First of all, I'm using this in a broad term. It includes home-based front stores, you know, like at the bottom of your house, in a slum area. It could be running a small eatery with your unpaid family members. It could include street vending. I can make the food and sell it, or I could buy the food from somewhere else and then sell it. So it involves a lot of things. One of the things that we've seen is that this self-insurance, the following, we think of it is because it's, you know, it they can bring the food, they can share it with their neighbors. It helps in terms of social support kind of thing. We see, for example, in Sari Sari store, many of the people in the same neighborhood would come there and have store credit. You allow them to borrow oil and then you just make a list and, you know, and collect it at the end of the month or wherever they have money. So it provides a lot of purpose. But there's also, I think, another interesting dimension about it, especially on sari-sari store or retail, this kind of retail trade variety store. It enables women to control earnings. You know, if earnings are fungible, we also see this in savings. If you put the money in the bank, your husband knows it, especially if the bank asks, well, you have to have a co-signer. We want to make sure that the husband knows you have savings. Well, then the husband knows that if they need some money, you have money there in the bank. Well, as soon as I have money, I'm going to buy cooking oil, and I'm going to buy rice. I'm going to put it in the street. It's my form of savings. So it's just like in some way, like television set, we always think the poor should not have TV sets. They can't afford it. But it is both a saving and a consumption. And I think understanding how people cope, that using it as a precautionary saving, if as soon as I have money, I buy a television so that I can use for enjoyment and bring the neighbors in. When I need the money, I pawn it or I sell it. And there is a very active pawning secondary asset market in many of these communities. Not documented, sometimes informal, sometimes formal in terms of pawn shops. Okay, I hope I answered all the questions.
Yeah. I'm not saying, first of all, you know, a major lesson from financial crisis to developing countries is to improve or modify the development model. That's something which is coming out very clearly from the experiences of this. I'm not denying that you can eliminate risk and vulnerability. Yeah. You cannot. But you can minimize it, mm-hmm, if you have development strategy which takes, right, care of some of these incidents. That's what I'm saying.
Yes, that's a very good point, yeah.